Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, damas y caballeros, leave it in.
Welcome back to another edition of Leaving the Ring Radio. I'm your host, Dave Duenas, with my co-host, Mr. Gable Montoya. We got a lot of stuff to talk about here on Leaving the Ring. We weren't on last week. I was actually sick. And so we're back, and we have to do some catch-up here on the show. And then we're going to talk about this upcoming weekend fights. Stephen Cunningham versus Amir Mansour is actually an interesting heavyweight fight. It's being hosted by a main event. And this should be some interest there a little bit. See where Cunningham's at, and if Amir's really what he's also said to be, right? And we got to talk about Mayfield and Virgil Hunter. And a little later, we're going to have Julian Ramirez, a prospect, is going to be calling into the show. We're going to talk some boxing there with him, find out a little bit about where his mind frame is at with his upcoming fight on Golden Boy Fox Sports 1. Anyways, let's see. What can we roll into really, really quick? I want to talk about Mayfield, man.
Yeah, let's just get the pain over with. You know, let's relive this.
Let's relive the. Here's the thing about Kareem Mayfield. He's from the Bay Area. I've covered him for what nine years, going on 10, I think. And before he was with Virgil Hunter, he was a one-handed puncher. Never really used more than one hand when he threw a combination. He was a fighter that grabbed and clinched. He was kind of a messy fighter. There was really no beauty to him, but he had power. That's one thing that stood out about him. Out of everything that he brought to the table, his power was definite. It was there. So he goes with Virgil Hunter, and the thought is because what Virgil has done with Andre Ward is he's going to be able to polish up Kareem Mayfield and make him look better, get him to the fundamentals of boxing, teach him how to use his footwork, teach him how to let his hands go, because Kareem really looked like a old version of Shane Mosley. And I don't know anybody out there, any fighter out there, that would want to look like the Sugar Shane Mosley of today. You want to look like Sugar Shane when he was blowing guys out at lightweight, which was 32 wins, 32 knockouts, right? But he wasn't doing that.
Yeah, pretty much.
And he's been with Virgil, I don't know what, maybe four, maybe even longer than that, 5 years. Can't really remember. And guess what? We still got the same fighter that I witnessed 9, 10 years ago, which is hold, use only one hand, rely on your power, feet are never underneath you, and you're kind of all over the place. Now, it's not Kareem Mayfield's fault. What it has to come down to sometimes, and this is the reason why I say it's not his fault. It's only partially his fault, because a fighter's got to want to change, and a fighter's got to recognize that they need change. And it could be that Kareem Mayfield doesn't recognize that he needs change because he was undefeated. And he was like, look, I'm undefeated. Nobody's beaten me. I've had some questionable wins, but hey, I got the zero at the end of my record. So why change my stripes? Right? But the writing was on the wall, which means when you step up in competition, when you start moving up in the ladder and you start facing stiffer competition out there, well, you have to be smart enough to realize that you got to add to your game. You got to tweak your game a little bit. You got to add to your skill level. And that's where the trainer comes in, right? That's why you hire a trainer, especially a trainer that's been voted as Trainer of the Year. So Kareem Mayfield grabs Virgil Hunter because his ultra success he's had with Andre Ward, that this is a definite, this is a no-brainer. You'll hire a guy that's been voted Trainer of the Year, that has polished an amateur fighter all the way to the Olympics to get gold, and goes to super middleweight and takes the Super 6 tournament, which was, he was not even in line to win that. It was Mikel Kessler. He accomplished all that. So the smart thing for Kareem Mayfield and his team was to hire on Virgil Hunter, who also lives in the Bay. He resides in the Bay. But after 5-6 years of being with Virgil Hunter, and I may be exaggerating on the years. It may be 4 years. I don't know. But you see the same fighter. So that's where you got to step back and start questioning, what is Hunter doing with him? So he answered my question Saturday night. He's there every round. There was never an instruction. There was a motivational speech to him.
Go to the next level, Dave.
Go to the next level. You know what? When he was talking like that, I honestly felt like I was going to a cheap church, a evangelist church, where they go, you know, the priest comes up there and says, come up here. Whoever has cancer, somebody here today is having money problems. Somebody here today has a situation with their girlfriend or their wife. Come up here. He reminded me of one of those con artist priests, which is a great bullshitter. But there's no substance. There's no realness behind those words. And on Twitter, somebody, I believe, Benny Paez is one of the Twitter guys. He said he's a infomercial. He's a great infomercial. I said, he honestly thought, you know what, Virgil, if you put him as a sales rep, a car dealer rep, or a telemarketer, this guy could just rake in all the commissions in the world because he's got a great mouthpiece. The sad part about it is that I praise Virgil Hunter. After the Super 6 tournament, I praised him. But remember this, folks. Now, some of you guys are going to be like, well, now, Dave, you're hating on Virgil Hunter? No, guys. If you followed and listened to Leave and Ring for quite some time, you would remember, like, last year, or was it 2 years ago? I don't remember my years here. But when Virgil Hunter decided to start bringing all these different fighters into his stable, what did I say? I said, this is where we're going to find out if Virgil Hunter is a really great trainer or if he's going to expose himself. Because sometimes what you do good with one fighter doesn't necessarily mean you're going to do great with the rest of them. And guess what? He did our job for us. He exposed himself in showing that he's not that really good of a trainer. Really isn't. What he's done with Andre Ward is great, and he should have stuck with that. But sometimes that little green demon can be a little too greedy, and no matter how good-hearted or supposedly how focused and grounded you are, that makes you kind of close your eyes sometimes, and you start believing the hype. You start believing that you are this great messiah for boxing. And when people start pointing the finger of the mistakes you're doing, like Saturday night was ridiculous. Saturday night, you left your soldier go into a battle and get murdered. You weren't even a general. A general has maps and statistics and schematics where he's going to tell you how to go about things. He's going to direct their fleet of how to attack. He just doesn't go, okay, gentlemen, they're going to be firing bullets at us. Take it to the next level, which is become like the Walking Dead. You get shot, get up.
Yeah, there was no plan, and it wasn't like Delorme was doing all that much that was so hard to handle. It wasn't like, wow, you know, on any given night, on any night, you know, Delorme would have beaten, or on this night, Delorme would have beaten anyone in the division. It was like one guy kind of doing little, and the other guy doing less, and nobody really, like, taking it. I mean, a couple times I thought early Mayfield got clipped, but he took it and he kept coming. He was there. But I didn't understand what the game plan was for him to just be in space and just kind of be there with the shorter arms and, like, not really work his jab, no jab, no real plan, winging the right hand, and then kind of getting inside and working both hands. But, I mean, it just – and Hunter was honest in saying, I don't regret this tomorrow. But at the same time, it's like he's absolving himself of the loss by putting it on the fighter. Instead of, like, where's the advice? And maybe you don't get, like, every second of the corner. So maybe the good advice was after the motivational speech. But it seemed to me like, really, he did the same thing with Angulo. And it's like, dude, I know Angulo about as well as anybody. And his English isn't so great that you can hit him with just complex, you know, issues or, you know, complex ideas. And certainly not complex sentences in the middle of a fight. You kind of just want to say, hey, you know, when he does this, step to your left, fire this punch. keep it simple. I'm not saying he's simple, but I mean, you know, talking to him about Tony Robbins shit isn't going to get it done. It didn't get it done in this fight, didn't get it done in that fight. We are starting to see a pattern, and I think the people, and maybe it's not fair to say this or make this comparison, because you have to take in a lot of factors, who each stable is allowed to fight, the matchmaking and promotion of each stable, all those factors. But when you look at each stable and a guy that like came up as a fighter, you know, a trainer of the year, Virgil Hunter, and a guy, the multiple trainer of the year, Freddie Roach, who gets derided for, well, you know, he's never really built anybody from scratch. But they're just counting the great skill that it is to take somebody and have them win where they may be kind of out you know, down the road a bit or past it. I mean, Manny Pacquiao had been knocked out twice before Roach got a hold of him and they went on their historic run. It's not that easy of a thing to reclaim a fighter. I think Virgil Hunter's finding that out. I don't think this also means, though, that I heard somebody else argue this. That's why I bring it up. It doesn't mean that Ward would have been great without Hunter, regardless. You know, like, he was just a great fighter and he would have been fine. You do have to be taken there. And Hunter built him from the ground up. So at some level, he is a good trainer. But like you said, you know, sometimes a guy has a system and not everybody fits into that system. And that's what I kind of see with Hunter, is that there is a system that he believes, you know, that he's teaching, or sort of a set way of doing things that he is teaching. And it doesn't work for all those guys. To me, a great trainer is one that looks at each person and sees them as an individual and brings out what's best left in them and brings out their true nature, the things that made them winners, and then maybe puts a little spin on it. But certainly what we're saying now is, it's one of the reasons I'm not really all up in those Trainer of the Year awards. This is the best person because of this fight or fighter. I just don't think it really works like that. If boxing can't be a league with the Super Bowl and the playoffs and shit, then why does it have end-of-the-year awards? That's how I look at it.
Let's bring in some callers really quick and see what they have to say about what happened Saturday night, 2 weeks ago, with Kareem Mayfield and Virgil Hunter. Let's go with area code 714. You're on live right now and Leaving the Ring. What's on your mind? 714, you out there, brother? Okay. In about 3 minutes, we're going to be having the prospect, Julian Ramirez, with us here on Leaving the Ring. And we're going to do a short interview with him, and then we're going to be moving on and talking a little bit more about what's going on in boxing. I definitely want to get into the subject about Mr. Al Haymon, Showtime, and Golden Boy in Top Rank. That's a conversation that, you know, we had about, what, 3, maybe 4 weeks ago. Steve Kim came on and weighed in a little bit about the feud that's happening in-house. But really, I didn't discuss what Al Haymon's role is behind everything. Because, you know, I mentioned this to a few people. I said, listen, I actually did a couple interviews this past weekend for the Boxing Blitz. And one of the topics is about Al Haymon. And one of the questions I asked is, look, Golden Boy, Richard Schaefer, Oscar De La Hoya, and Bob Arum, they've had this feud. It's like it's a triangle, love triangle between these guys. But at the same time, they're not really noticing what Al Haymon is doing. And that I'm wondering why they haven't taken concern about what Al Haymon is doing on the sidelines, which is signing every fighter possible out there and building a stable. I mean, to me, it's almost the way United States ignored North Korea and Russia, and they allowed them to start gathering all these mass destructive weapons, and we concentrated on, you know, the Mideast. I don't get why they haven't really took notice, and if we're, I mean, us as media, as journalists, are noticing what Al Haymon is doing, why haven't these guys picked up on it? I don't understand that. Gabriel?
Well, you know, I think in the case of Bob, I think on some level, you know, everybody looks at this business their own way. But I mean everybody, I'm talking about the powers that be, all the different promoters. You know, how big a place at the table is there for them? It's interesting to see, I mean, there's certain promoters like, let's say, Dan Goosen and Ludabella are two I could think of right off the top of my head. And these are guys that have done business with Al and been that front guy. You know, Berto wasn't really DeBellis. He was with him, but he wasn't really with him. He was with Al. And it was an open secret. And there are many open secrets in this business, as it turns out. Paul Williams, I don't believe, had paper. And Chris Areola, I don't believe, has paper with Dan Goosen. But it's a nice relationship. It all works out. And they're with Al. And to me, that was like those guys allowed this kind of way of doing business to take root, which kind of frustrates me with Lou when he complains about the business and then he partakes in acts that actually kind of hurt the business. It's counterintuitive to me. I'm a little disingenuous. But with Bob, I think, because he's a big fish, he doesn't really have to worry about – he didn't have to worry about Al Heyman. It would piss him off when he would take his dates or, you know, he would kind of get in the way. Certainly taking over Mayweather, I'm sure, was pretty upsetting. I mean, they invested a ton in Floyd and were going to do their own thing with him as a pay-per-view attraction, and that just got all taken away. They didn't handle it then because I don't know if they knew what to do with it. It's a dirty business and people steal your guys, but you don't really know
right.
what Al's going to become, you know. But when they moved to
Showtime, it is a dirty business. It's a dirty business, radio. Radio is a dirty business. Hey, I got to patch in Julian Ramirez. I believe we have him on here with us. Julian, you there, brother?
Yeah, hello.
What's up, man? How you doing? Thanks for coming on Leaving the Ring Radio, bro. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Hey, welcome to the show, Julian. It's Gabriel Montoya and Dave Duenas is the guy you just talked to. I'm Gabe Montoya with MaxBoxing.com. Really enjoying where your career's going, man. When we first have somebody on, what we like to do is really just kind of introduce them to the boxing fans. We kind of start at the very beginning. How did you first find yourself in a boxing gym?
Well, my cousins, they were training at the gym already. And I told one of my cousins, like, I could beat you up still, you know, even though you're training. And I went to the gym, I sparred with him, and, you know, ever since that, I never looked back. I just kept training.
That's like a Latino thing, you know what I mean? Because, you know, when I was growing up, I'd be playing in the sandbox, and some kid would come and throw sand in my face, and I'd be like, yo, what's up? And then the kid would go, hey, your brother said that you could kick my ass. And I'm fighting.
Yeah, you can't let yourself. So, yeah, that's what it was. I mean, I went to the gym and I tried to go at it with him, and then I just kept boxing ever since that day.
And you're from your birthplace is Pasadena, but you're from East LA. Can you explain that?
That's where I've always trained at and played all my sports. You know. That's where my parents lived all over the place in L.A. And, yeah, I mean, that's what I represent because that's where I've always trained at. The gyms are in East L.A., and that's where I've always trained at. So I rep East L.A.
And that's where you were basically discovered by Joel De La Hoya, right, your manager. He saw you, so I understand, like your second pro fight or third pro fight. And
yeah.
From there, you guys started to work together?
Yeah. After my second fight, he saw me and he was like, you know, we should go eat and, you know, talk. And yeah, after my second fight, he was just like, you know, I signed with him he's been managing me. He manages me ever since my second fight.
I really like the way they're building you too. I mean, I thought you're fighting those kind of prospect guys, you know, not exactly the most winning records, but guys that'll do something with you. And particularly your last fight, I was really impressed with, which was against Derek Wilson. Can you talk about that fight a little bit? I mean, what you learned in it? You went the whole route, you know, you went 8 rounds, but it was dominant performance.
I mean, he's a good fighter, Derek Wilson. They told me. You know, you're going to fight Derek Wilson. And I told him, well, let's do it. You know, I know he's a tough fight, and I know he'll get me out there because I know boxing fans and boxing people know who he is. You know, he pulls upsets. I trained really hard for him, and, you know, I wanted to get the knockout, but at the same time, it went the 8 rounds, and people saw that I could last the 8 rounds and still – go extra rounds because I wasn't tired. I was still fresh after the 8th round. I still had energy. So, I mean, I learned a lot. You know, I kept my calm when I had to, and, you know, I was aggressive when I had to fight, and it was a good fight. I liked my fight.
And you're the great nephew of Renato Hernandez. Also, you know, I'm curious, well, first, before I ask about that, talk to me about where you train, who you train with, what led you to that particular gym.
Well, I train in two gyms. I train in GTO Boxing. It's in El Sereno. It's in L.A. And then I train in Pico, City Pico. My trainer is Rafael Sarabia. And since a little kid, he was always like he was always a backup trainer. He was always like a trainer in the gyms where he just works on fundamentals with guys, and then the more advanced trainers come and they take the fighters. And he never got a chance to, like, he always built fighters like with their fundamentals, but he never got a chance to take any of his fighters anywhere. And he would always help me, and, you know, he was always a good guy. And you know, I just started working with him. I was just like, can you help me? And he was like, yeah, you know, whenever you want. And I just work with him. He's all fundamentals, and I mean, that's what I think helps me a lot.
Yeah, describe yourself as a fighter. I was gonna say you're very fundamentally sound for a guy that I tend to think that you think of yourself as a puncher. I mean, certainly the way you put down Wilson early in the fight, that's, you know, the way they talked about you is that you're a big hitter. But it's always kind of early to tell in this part of your career. But talk to me about what you think you are as a fighter.
I think I'm a smart fighter. I think I know how to throw my guys off, and I mess with my opponents. If they're doing one thing, I'm doing the opposite. I have them thinking, and I mean, I do have a little punch. I'm not the fastest guy, and I know how to use my length good. So, but yeah, I mean, I think I'm just a boxer puncher.
You're pretty big for the weight class, too. I mean, do you think because you're still a prospect and kind of growing, do you think that when you make your title run, if you get to that point, that's going to be at this weight, or do you think you're going to move up to make that serious move?
Well, right now I'm going to try getting the title at 122, and then move up to 126, 130. And the amateurs, I fought at 123. And 125 since I was like 14, so I've been at that weight for a long time already. And then I fought in amateurs, like at the end I was fighting at 132. So I mean, I don't see a problem going up either. So it just depends if I could make the weight for another like two years, 3 years. You know, hopefully get a shot at a title shot at 122. Then I'll stay at 122.
Are you a natural southpaw?
Yes.
Like you're left-handed, and you know, when you're not beating people up.
Yeah. I write with my left. You know, I play baseball. I throw with my left. Everything. I do everything with my left.
Oh wow!
And nobody ever tried to discourage you when you started boxing? Like when you lined up like a southpaw, no one was like, "No, wait a minute, switch to the other side."
They told me, you know what, if you box right-handed, you're going to be stronger. But, you know, it felt uncomfortable because I do everything with my left. So, and stand, you know, my whole stance, everything. So I was like, I'm going to just do it this way. And, I mean, if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. But, yeah, they try to change me, but I was stubborn about it.
Who gave you your nickname, El Camarón?
My great-grandpa. I started training with him, and I used to be with him like for like the whole summer, because I started training in the summer, and I was with him, and every day after the gym I would stay red, and then he would take me to a buffet, whatever, and he would be like, "That's my little shrimp right there, get whatever you want, that's my little shrimp," and and then I would go get shrimp. That was my favorite.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. What is the most difficult part for yourself in boxing to stay focused and determined that you have to always continuously work on?
The hardest part, I have a lot of friends, you know. I have, friends that like to go out, you know. But I'm not really, in that party scene, but I do like a lot of women, you know. So that's kind of, that's kind of hard, you know, staying away from the girls. But other than that, getting to the gym and you know, working out, all that stuff, I love it, you know. I look forward to it. When I'm in the gym, I love doing everything. I love competing with everybody in the gym. I'm a competitor. So if there's somebody in the gym, I'm happy because I'm going to outwork them no matter, what they bring. And other than that, nothing.
That's a good advice. You know, I mean, it's better than saying, well, you know, the training's great, but, you know, cocaine, I just can't get enough of it. You know, women, that's just natural.
yeah, it's just the women. I mean, I don't drink or anything. I just hit 21, but even since before that, I went to Mexico one time, I was 16, and I drank and never again, you know. I was throwing up left to right, and after that, I've never wanted to even look at beer, never do anything like that.
And let's be honest though too though, you know, just like any type of drug that can ruin your life, remember women can do the same thing.
women are men's downfall a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. That's probably the hardest thing is that you go through so many stages as a boxer, from an amateur to prospect to contender and hopefully to title holder. And all through that, you've got to be your own business. You're the one that's going to make you train. You can have a trainer, but nobody's going to make you work out. Nobody's going to make you not eat that cookie or whatever. Talk to me about the difference for you that you're finding as a professional, like David's talking about being disciplined versus being an amateur. Do you feel more responsibility because there's now money on the line?
Right now, not that much, you know. I'm not hurting or anything, but, there is a difference in amateurs, and I actually liked, training in amateurs because at that time I was sparring every Saturday, I would train the whole week hard because every Saturday I was sparring with pros and I wanted to beat up the pros bad, you know. I wanted to beat up the Arce brothers, you know, the Castillo Martin, the only guy I sparred with, so many pros, at 16 and 15 years old, the only guy that my dad never let me spar was Salido. He walked into the gym, and I didn't know who he was. You know, I was just ready. I had my game face on. I was ready, wrapped up, and my dad was like, "Hell no, he's not gonna spar with that guy." And I was like, "Who is he?" You know, I was like, "Who is he?" And my dad's like, Salido, and I didn't know who he was, so I was like, I could spar with him, but not till later on, I saw that you know, he beat up Juanma and
right,
and yeah, but I used to just train hard for that Saturday, every Saturday, and the amateurs, I had more fun, just training, not fighting in the amateur fights. And right now, being a pro, it just comes natural. I like training, and I like being fit.
That's great that your dad did that for you too, because you know what? Sometimes fathers, we tend to let our own pride and ego get in the way, and we want our kids to kind of, you know, show the machismo that we have. And your dad did the right thing by saying, "Listen, you're too young. You know, we still got a long way to go." That's a good thing, man, that your old man did that. That's good to hear, because a lot of times you don't hear that anymore. I see guys take their kids, and their kids will take a massive whooping. Where I've literally have had to walk over to a father and say, "Hey, I don't think your son should be putting on gloves, man. He just doesn't have it in him." Because let's be honest, boxing's not for everybody. You know, I know some people want to make it into a recreational sport. But it isn't. It just isn't.
Yeah, it's boxing. People die in this sport. You know, it's dangerous. You know, I wouldn't I don't like that either. If somebody's getting beat up, I'll be the one to stop it in the ring, because I don't think it's right. You know, people get hurt in this sport.
Let me ask you, what's your
favorite fighter? Oh, go ahead, Dave.
I was going to ask him, what was his favorite punch? What's your favorite punch that you like to throw and that you feel is your money punch? Is the one that's going to get you out of trouble, that you can depend on and rely on?
My money punch, probably my straight left. My right hook is really, really strong, but I think my left, I just feel comfortable letting it go. But my favorite punch to throw is probably my jab. I love throwing my jab. I don't know. I like clowning people with my jab.
who's your favorite fighter?
Probably Finito Lopez and Mike Tyson. Those are my two favorite.
Oh man,
that's interesting. Why each guy? That's a great combination.
I like Finito, how he would set up everybody with, you know, his feints and jabs and, you know, and then knock him out with that upper. I like throwing that upper too, but I throw a right upper. I like throwing that upper.
Yeah.
And Mike Tyson, I just like, I mean, what is it not to like about Mike Tyson? He's aggressive, you know. I like being aggressive. I like being in the ring and scaring my opponents, you know. Not doing nothing crazy, you know, yelling or anything like that, but, you know, just you know, staring them down, the way he trained. I like everything about Mike Tyson. He's a beast.
Yeah,
awesome.
He was
yeah.
When he was young, man. He was a beast.
Let's
talk a little bit.
Oh,
I know. Yeah.
Good.
He was in his own. Let's talk a little bit about your upcoming fight on Fox Sports 1. What do you know about your opponent? What have you seen about your opponent? And what are your concerns about your opponent?
I've seen him fight against Jojo Diaz, Joseph Diaz, the Olympian. I saw him fight against him, and you know, he's a tough guy. He stays kind of right there in the pocket. And I don't know. I train hard for him, and I'm ready for whatever he brings. I mean, I saw him fight, and I'm not going to expect the same guy that night, because you never know. You know, maybe that was like 4 months ago. Maybe he switched up something, but I'm ready for whatever he brings.
Let me ask you this, because a lot of times you get prospects like yourself that are moving up in the ladder, and their main concern is to showcase knockout rather than working on rounds and on their technique and try to expose what their weakness is so that they can go back to the gym and work on it. What is your main concern? Is it to have a showcase and look fantastic, or is it to put in rounds so that you can extend your career into a good long run?
I don't think I'm not that type of fighter that looks in at a fight like, oh, I want to go, you know, 6 rounds or 8 rounds this time because I want to learn more. I think learning should be in the gym. And, I mean, in the fight, naturally, you're going to learn because, you know, stuff's going to happen. But I think all the learning should be done in the gym, because you don't get paid more for going an extra round. You know, so if I could get a knockout in the first, you know, 30 seconds, a minute, I'm happy with that. You know, and little by little, I mean, people are going to be like, oh, this guy, they're going to have questions like, this guy probably can't last, you know, the whole fight, or this guy, you know, he'll probably get tired, but
right.
Let them think that, you know, I don't get paid going more rounds. I get paid, you know, just to fight. So if I knock the guy out early, I'm happy with that. And if I don't, then, you know, I'm ready.
Right. Does it put pressure on you seeing that Joseph Diaz was in there? Do you feel like, I got to do better than him? I got to go in there and I got to show that I'm a far more skilled and powerful fighter than Joseph Diaz. Do you kind of feel that on that edge?
Nah, I mean, we're barely coming up, so I don't feel like, oh, you know, I got to knock this guy out, you know, before the thing. I think he stopped him like in the 7th or something. I don't look at it like, oh, I got to stop him before that, or, you know, it is what it is, you know. I mean, one day we'll probably end up fighting, so that, that would happen. That's gonna show who's better, or you know, who trained harder or whatever. So right now it's like whatever. I mean, right now it's just another opponent that I'm gonna fight.
You know, when you mentioned that eventually, you know, at some point you guys may end up fighting. If you guys continue both moving on and wins and moving up on the ladder, that you're going to end up crossing paths. But let me ask you, how much does that play in your mind and add to your motivation in the gym in terms of looking at a future opponent? I mean, which one of these prospects out there or future champions out there that you're hoping that you envision that you're going to get a shot at and is going to be the opportunity to get that major exposure that most fighters want, that the world can finally get a great big glimpse of what you bring to the table in the boxing game?
Well, I don't call out fighters, and I don't like to, like, I think that's like disrespecting them. I don't like to diss any fighters. But I mean, whoever, if I move up in the rankings, if I get to like the rankings, whoever has a title, I'm down to fight them or whoever. And you know, it may be some of the prospects right now, or it may be like somebody that we don't know of, you know, Pancho from down the street. Like, you know, it could be whoever. And if he has a title, I want to fight him.
Well, there you go, fight fans. Julian Ramirez here on Leaving the Ring. Hey, brother, I want to wish you all the luck. Thanks for coming on, and I can't wait to have you back on Leaving the Ring Radio.
All right, thank you. Thanks for having me on, guys.
All right,
hey,
brother.
Our pleasure,
take
man.
Care.
Thank you. Good luck.
Bye.
Fight fans, you want to call in and talk some boxing here on Leaving Ring, you certainly can. 347-215-7598. Don't forget to download the app to your iPhone and your Android to catch the next round, Book Sale Tijuana Radio and Leaving Ring Radio, and soon to be on, really soon, is the Boxing Blitz. I'm almost there with it. Just got a few more touches with the episodes, and then I'll start posting them on there. I hope everybody's going to enjoy what we're producing. You know, yeah, I hope so. You know, we put in a lot of work, you know. Not all of them are going to be gold. I'm hoping at least one out of six that's going to be really good, that people are going to remember and kind of see the hard work that we did put into the Boxing Blitz. Okay, Sergey Kovalev, this guy, Jesus, man. I mean, the punches the guy was landing on Saturday night, you know, there was a storm over here in Modesto, and I got to tell you that thunder, but the only thunder that I could hear was Kovalev's punches on Cedric Agnew. Agnew was a guy that had defense, hand speed. There was a strong possibility that Agnew was the guy that was going to, you know, show something out of what Sergey can do that couldn't do. And Kovalev just went out there. I mean, there's a reason why he calls himself the Crusher. His crunching punches, everything he landed, it didn't matter if it was the shoulder, the forearm, or the glove. There was a significant thump, a significant thump to that. And let me ask you this. When's the last time we heard of a light heavyweight like Sergey that could punch like that, that had this punch that was just really scary, you know, where, you know, like Tito Trinidad had this scary power when he landed. He had this accuracy that was like, wow. Sergey, I wouldn't put him that far into the category of Tito Trinidad. I think it's going to take a lot for anybody to be measured at Tito Trinidad level. But punching power, dude, this guy's got he's got a gift. That power is real.
Even Pacquiao at some point, although, you know, some of that was matchmaking. But I would say let's look at Tito, because it's a longer track record of just straight-up knockouts. Like Pacquiao, he's got some knockouts, but, I mean, Tito was just kind of a different guy, but to me, the thing that was actually kind of Pacquiao-esque here with Kovalev was that he does – his power, it seems effortless, very much like Tito as well. It flows within his combinations, but his feet don't necessarily have to be set, which is very much unlike Tito and kind of like Pacquiao. That left, that first left that was kind of like a jab hook, like he hooked just at the last second off that jab. It was deceptive, but it was also like coming kind of from the rear and he was moving while doing it. I mean, that's a very rare thing. He's just got ridiculously heavy hands. Power's always been that kind of mythic thing in the sport. You know, either you just have it or you don't. Either you've got these ridiculous bones, and then everything also connects within the sinew, and you just know how to deliver it, or you don't. And even some guys, like Paulie Malignaggi, has great technique. Like, he'll come right down the pipe and land some good shots. He just can't knock you out. That's just not what he does. You know, he might be able to knock me out, but he's not going to knock out your average fighter. I don't know what it is about Kovalev, man, but he also, like you said, this is also like Tito, is that he does kind of crush your guard. He'll be like, fine, you're going to shell up? Well, I'm going to beat the hell out of your wrists and your forearms. I'm going to hit you in the shoulder. I'm going to crash through that guard until finally I get you. And, you know, boxing IQ, too, he found that left of the body. It was like, all right, he's going to shell up, but there's this little spot off to the side. I'm just going to find my way in there, and I'm going to just keep hitting it, and in a few rounds it's going to break, and then he will. And that's exactly what happened. I was very impressive. I mean, Agnew was a reluctant guy, but I think Kovalev's power made him that way a little bit. The year layoff kind of didn't help his cause either. But I think Kovalev, as soon as this guy felt it, it was like, well, maybe I'll wait a few rounds. He'll get tired. Okay, he's not tired. And then that Kirkland thing, by the time you get to the fourth or fifth, you're kind of too beat up to really begin mounting any sort of significant offense. And then it's over. That was very impressive.
Really impressive. You know, I mean, obviously there's going to be more questions that need to be answered by Kovalev, but he's answering them fairly well. He's passing the tests that are being presented to him. Adonna Stevenson, you know, some are suspecting that he jumped ship because of that crushing power that Kovalev brings to the table, you know. But, you know, if you look at Stevenson's business move, you know, if you get a shot at Bernard Hopkins, which may be could lead to a little bit more money and a safer fight, because you're not going to be facing a power puncher and an accurate power puncher at the light heavyweight division. You know, Bernard Hopkins doesn't look to knock you out. He looks to outgame you, outclass you, outmaneuver you, which is rightfully what an older fighter should always try to do. That's what's kind of kept them in the game. But it sucks, because we're out of a really, you know, when you talk about super fights, that is a super fight that I think most of us fight fans want to watch. We want to see. We're being cheated out of seeing a great matchup between two in their prime light heavyweights, and a really good light heavyweight fight in that matter. You know, I mean, the last time I think we had a really good light heavyweight fight where everybody wanted to see was, man, back in the 80s when Holyfield was around, I think. And I don't think Boy Jones and Antonio Tarver was one of those heavyweight fights that everybody wanted to witness, you know?
Well, light heavyweight, yeah. No, I haven't really.
Has there been a fight at light heavyweight division? Really, honestly, has there been a fight at a light heavyweight division where everybody's been like, ooh, I really want to see this? A lot of times in light heavyweight division, it's always one-sided. It's always one guy really, really good and dominant, and then the rest of the division is just kind of there.
You know what I mean? And Tarver really had no interest for me. I didn't think it was a good matchup. I thought Tarver would be funky anyways, coming off that, losing all the weight, and turned out he was. It was like he just got him at the right time. It was Hopkins got it striking at the right time.
But those were two guys with no crushing power. You know what I mean? Tarver had good power, but it wasn't that.
There's nothing
wow, power.
Mythic about any of these other fights. But Stevenson Kovalev?
Dude, that's an explosion.
I know we can survive losing Super Bowls, but you know, I wrote that piece today, Kathy Duva, on the you know, possibly dying art of promotion. And you look at it, she pointed out like that back in the day, like, you know, Dan Duva, Don King, Bob Arum would be mad at each other. They did not like each other. And probably, you know, on some level still don't. But when there came to be that big fight, they made it. You know, when fights made sense, they made them. You mean, imagine, like Trinidad Vargas wouldn't even have. As much as we'll debate about, like, whether or not Vargas was ready or not, I still say he was ready. Even though he was young, he did have some names, and he was a precocious kid. But at the same time, like, that fight made logical sense at the time. Like, what other fights were Tito going to do? Was he going to bypass and hope that maybe Vargas one day moves to 60? Or do you take the fight now? And they, you know, there's that fight. There's Trinidad De La Hoya. There's endless fights throughout the years. What we're seeing now is just like, ha-ha, we're just going to game the system, make a bunch of money, sell you a bunch of crap, and you're going to buy it because you're an addicted boxing fan, and we'll just keep promising you something else. Like, you'll get something better that we think you'll like even more, even though we never really do. And that's Kovalev Stevenson. Right now, what's going on in the business, we keep talking about it. It's hard to talk about this fight without talking about all this stuff, is that we're seeing a monopolization of the sport, a UFCing, if you will. And we talked about it earlier. You know, Bob didn't feel like he needed to deal with this problem at the time. He just didn't feel like it because they did the business their way. They developed stars slowly. They've been doing it for years. You know, Sugar Ray Leonard, De La Hoya, Floyd Mayweather to an extent. And it's worked. You know, they make little stars, even if they don't last that long. Kelly Pavlik did some business for a while. He kind of imploded. But they're still able to do that. And they feel that's the way to do it. What Kathy talked about, you know, you build your brand with this fighter. You build him as a brand. At the same time, you teach him how to be a fighter by matching him well. That's why I like what's going on with Julian Ramirez's career. It looks like he's being matched right. Derek Wilson was a great fight at the right time for him to find out what they had, and he came through very well. I was glad that he got the rounds instead of, like, that first-round knockout. And watching this, like, you know, with Stevenson, he's going to go over, he's going to fight. We're gonna, the thing that we are supposedly supposed to feel like is better is Hopkins' fight with Adonis Stevenson, and it just isn't. But it keeps everything in-house, keeps everything over there in control. Golden Boy, Showtime, Al Haymon, who you name it, they all have it. And Kovalev now is somehow lesser than. He's got to go some other route and figure right. things out. And we, as boxing fans, lose out on the thing that we would have had. It just makes sense because that's just this business that's been turned into. But as a sport, it makes zero sense. And in terms of building the sport for the future, for all of our futures, not just Golden Boy's future or Showtime's or Al Haymon's, it just doesn't make a lot of sense to not have the Super Bowl when you can because they're rare.
Yeah, they are. Fight fans, you want to call in 347-215-7598, you certainly can. Let's talk some boxing. You can follow us on Twitter, on Leave in the Ring, all capital letters, LIITRBOXING. Follow Mr. Gabriel Montoya on his Twitter account, which is Gabriel_Montoya. Be sure to download the app. Check it out. Download it. You can catch up with the next round, Boxeo Tijuana Radio, and Leave It in the Ring. Download and rate on your Android or your iPhone. You know, going back with Al Haymon and what he's doing is a brilliant move. You know, you're allowing the other people to fog their vision so that you can come through the back door, clean house, clean out all the furniture, the electronics, open up the safe because you're too busy in the front yard arguing with the neighbor. Al Haymon is doing that brilliantly. You know, I told you, I compared him to Bruce Willis from The Last Man Standing. He made the two mafias keep trying to go at each other's throats while he was making deals in between them. Well, Al Haymon is not making deals in between them. What he's doing is he's taking away all the deals. He's sewing up all the fighters. He's sewing up the game so that opening, the door that's open to both promoters, it's slowly but surely starting to get smaller and smaller and smaller. Now, could he go back with HBO and continue a business relationship with them? I'm not really sure. But when there's money involved and there's money on the table, companies can forgive and forget, which is very surprising that top-ranking Golden Boy can't seem to forgive and forget in terms of it's really Schaefer not wanting to forgive and forget and Bob Arum. It seems like Oscar wants to forgive and forget. You know, and say, hey, let's get together. Let's make these fights happen. Because you would think that what makes all two of those men drive with Schaefer and Bob Arum is money. I mean, that is the sole purpose of them being in this business. Schaefer used to call us consumers, not boxing fans.
Yeah.
Al Haymon seems to get it. You know, whether you like him or not, whether you think he's bad for boxing, he may be bad for boxing fans, But he's not. He's definitely not bad for boxing business for fighters. He's bringing them all the money that they should be getting. Maybe at that, not at the peak of where they're getting the money at in their career. You know, I honestly think you need to earn it before you're getting paid the amount that you're getting, Andre Berto. But
well, this is the thing too that I look at the business and with Al Haymon, and it's like, okay, he comes from the music business. You know, he works with, you know, he's Beyonce's manager or whatever people say. And I say, well, like, one, I'm not a Beyonce fan. Like, I'm not, you know, Jay-Z's last album was a big
deal. I'm a fan of her booty.
Like, even that's kind of overrated. I just think, but you look at the music industry, and maybe this makes me an old guy, but I tend not to think so. I do listen to modern music, just not mainstream, like top 40 shit, like Beyonce stuff. And to me, like Bieber, like all that stuff is like crap. Like the stuff that's at the Grammys, like I don't watch the Grammys anymore because it's all crap. And people buy it, and it's all very microwavable, disposable garbage that's not going to stand the test of time, like such as a Johnny Cash or an Elvis, people that actually innovate and create, like, new things and are actually good, you know, like value lyrics. Like, I always love seeing those comparisons of lyrics from the past versus lyrics now. The music's incredibly dumbed down, but the way music is sold these days, like iTunes and all that, it's just so, like, easy to get. Like, you know, it's like being at the checkout counter, you know, the impulse buy. That's kind of music nowadays. And people buy it. They don't really care about it that much. It's just garbage. And like, again, maybe this makes me sound like an old guy. But I look at that because people don't really care about the quality. It's got a beat. You can kind of move to it. It resembles kind of what was good music before. And so they buy it. And you look at the boxing, there's mixing and matching, and all these kind of just retread fights or complete mismatches. You know, you notice Al always takes the chance. Steve pointed this out. It was a very astute observation. He takes the chance when he has both sides, you know, Garcia, Matisse. But when it's just his guy and his guy has something to lose, like generally it's just a gigantic mismatch that's being sold to us. And people buy it, and they're cool. Like, you know, it was like Golden Boy's, you know, taking over. Showtime's taking over HBO, even though that had no basis in reality. But people generally just kind of follow, you know, like a herd mentality. And Al's capitalized on that. And you look at the boxing media and how freaking easy it is to get a credential, myself included. I started as a poster. Six articles in, I was covering a fight ringside, interviewing all the biggest names, you know, certainly for that fight, in boxing, with no credentials to really do so other than somebody said you could be there. And I had a tape recorder. So when you look at what Al did, like the takeover, like our business is so ripe for it. It's not really regulated. There's 50 states. They have different rules, regulations. Nobody really gives a shit about the Ali Act. You have a boxing media that really isn't trained to do that and really has no inclination to actually, you know, challenge the powers that be, speak any sort of truth to power. I mean, just evidence of that. How many times has Tim Bradley had his testing revoked after they said they're doing VADA and Bob kind of obstructs it? People say, oh, it's great, but nobody really gives you details. Even that the recent testing results that were released, tell me, I don't think EPO or CIR testing was done for Pacquiao Marquez, but nobody's really digging at it. I'm one of the very few, if only, guys that is doing it. When you put that kind of climate and a group of sheeple, and, you know, we all know who the good ones are, the ones that actually do their job. There's a very few of them. I don't need to run through the list to feel like favorites. But the general mass, look at, like, the side I took a shot at today. A lot of guys on there. Maybe there's a few that are trying to be honest, you know, do an honest hustle with reporting. I'm not really seeing it. By and large, most people they do the friendly interview. You know, it's the what's coming up? What do you feel about this? What's trending on Twitter question that I can ask? What do you got coming up? How was training camp? Not much else after that. There's not a lot of challenging going on. And so Al was able to swoop in. With Bob thinking, hey, I've got my thing on lock. This is how I do it. Kathy's got her whole area on lock. Nobody really working together because the Boxing Promoters Association is an absolute joke. They can't even update their website, much less agree on anything. And nobody's ever called them on that.
Right.
You look at that whole climate. How, you know, why wouldn't Al just look at it and go, you know, I just take over the other network, promise them, you know, bigger returns against the giant. They don't need to take over, but this guy could be competing or look like it. I'll bring Floyd over, just like, you know, Tyson with Don King back in the day. and let's make some moves. Let's be aggressive. But first I'll learn how to do it by, you know, getting my feet wet for a few years, and then I'll just swoop in. And a puppet, you know, guy like Richard Schaefer, who's willing to just be, you know, CEO for hire is what it looks like. This is my opinion of the situation. You know, Oscar doesn't seem to care. I'll just use his name, and let's go to work. There's no checks and balances. I mean, why has this been an open secret, Abe, for years, that guys are just with Al Heyman, and he's calling the shots, and these promoters are fronting for him for a flat fee, and nobody does anything about it?
You know,
everybody
I'm
wants
gonna
to be in on the party.
I'm going to weigh in a little bit at that, but I'm going to take some calls here. Let's go with, I think we got our friend Rob Riddler on the line with us. Rob, you there, brother?
Yo, what's good?
What's up, man?
What's good, brother? What's on your mind?
Well, I want to open my statement by saying Danny Garcia is a bum. yo.
What is that based on?
Yo, his last fight, I've never been happier and felt more Mexican in my life. oh, my God. Yeah, I was going off. I almost went to Puerto Rico just to ride in a car and wave the Mexican flag through the streets. But not that anything would happen. I'd probably safely make it to the airport like Bernard Hopkins did. But just on the Super Bowl boxing thing and this Timothy Bradley stuff. Like, boxing really hasn't been about the Super Bowl fights in a minute now. It's more or less what they want you to believe is the Super Bowl fight. Like, they'll have you believe Miguel mm-hmm. Cotto at, like, 34 years old, not really washed up, you know, not really washed up to action, just he's missing something now in his career. He fights Floyd, and that's supposed to be, like, the, you know, the Super Bowl, you know, whatever. And when the real Super Bowl fights back in the day were, you know, Camacho and Bazooka, you know, Limon and Camacho Chavez, or, you know, all these other types of fights with these, I guess you could say, where one fighter was not so well known unless you were a hardcore fight fan or he had his nation behind him versus the guy that everybody knew. And that's where those upsets happen, but now they want the money, they want to avoid all that. And now we got to get Timothy Bradley talking like he's in a Super Bowl fight. He's out here talking like Pacquiao did lose his killer instinct, but he still has enough killer instinct to knock Bradley out.
See,
Bradley
I think
stop.
That one that fight is actually a relevant fight. Like,
it
I agree
is.
With all
this
stuff. Like, it's been watered down. People that kind of denigrate Pacquiao Bradley too is a fight that, like, so I had some guy kind of complaining to me on email about that fight and about Kathy Duva's comments about how Top Rank kind of does it right. It's kind of hard to, you know, they do obstruct every now and again, but generally they've been a part of creating big stars and building them the right way, or they're a draw on multiple levels and all that. But to me, this fight's a good fight. I know, Tim, it's weird to hear a guy talk when he wears, you know, Grant gloves, doesn't seem to knock people out, but then he talks like he's going to knock somebody out and he's going to knock, you know, Pacquiao senseless or whatever. I kind of agree with him, though. Wouldn't you agree that Pacquiao did kind of seem to lose his fire? He looks a little weird to me.
Yeah,
like,
I mean,
Mannequin Manny.
Yeah, he's lost his fire. I mean, like, I told Dave this when Pacquiao got knocked out, because previous to Pacquiao getting knocked out, I felt like he was pushing it with the Marquez thing. I don't think he should have took that fight, because
nah.
I told Dave, I feel like he's going to get knocked out. And, like, when
right.
he got knocked out, I said the thing that happened in that fight was Pacquiao was normal Pacquiao, like recent Pacquiao, for the early parts of the fight. When he got knocked down, he went to old Pacquiao, and by then it was too late. So who knows what type of Pacquiao we're going to see now, but, you know, if we're going to see the Pacquiao that fought this kid, Rios, Bam Bam Rios, then, you know, I don't know, because he has lost his kind of that viciousness where he's just trying to knock your head off and, like,
he doesn't really,
you know,
follow through. He doesn't follow through anymore with his punches. You know, I mean, I think what happened with him by getting knocked out by Marquez is two things. Is that we knew that Manny was a religious person, but getting knocked out and seeing the light of that tunnel on the mat, I think he found religion on that mat.
That is so,
you know?
That's so foul right there. Yo,
I'm just saying, man.
It's so true. Becky,
you know,
Pacquiao
get...
finally wakes up, and he wakes up to terrors everywhere. Just terrors
right.
by everybody. You know, I mean, he's good. He's still good. He's still relevant. But the thing that made Manny dangerous was that he wanted, it looked like he wanted to kill somebody with the way he was fighting. Like, you know, he doesn't have that anymore. And Bradley, to me, this is a dangerous fight for Bradley because I don't know if Bradley wants Pacquiao. It wants to be the first person Pacquiao starts that against. He starts that up against.
Think about
because,
Bradley. I think the thing about Bradley is that he's got a sweet spot on his chin. Bradley can get hurt, you know, and if Bradley's going in there, you know, overconfident, thinking that the Marquez fight solidifies that he can do this to any fighter out there, then he's actually setting himself up for destruction because, like you said, Manny may not have that killer instinct all way, all full effect, but I'll tell you what, even the old dog, when he smells blood, he's going to do his best to attack. And I think Manny, being an old dog, still got some teeth left. He may not have them all fully in there. He may have some dentures, you know, mixed up in those live teeth of his. But I still think he has the ability to, if he hits that sweet spot, I don't think he's going to let up on it. I think he's going to continue. If he sees I can hurt Timothy this time and hurt him bad, I can go for the kill. With Rios, he saw he couldn't do it. Couldn't hurt him, you know?
Yeah, it's weird because Manny has that type of power where it's situational. Like he can knock you down if you're on the back foot. If you're really really scared and you're just gonna let him start beating on you, then he's gonna hurt you eventually because then he's gonna get all the situations he wants. But the type of knockouts with Ricky Hatton and stuff, that's all like kind of the Barrera fights and that's all kind of situational stuff. Like he gets that angle and like uncorks it. He doesn't have that anymore. He doesn't really look for those situations anymore, but Bradley is, like, feeling himself a little too much. Like, he was in that Marquez fight really feeling himself. He reminds me of John Jones.
Bradley could give him that situation, though, because Bradley does things that Hatton does. One, they're kind of comparable size, and I think that's what really contributed to Hatton getting knocked the hell out. He was just right there, and I remember watching in the wild card Broch and Pacquiao working. And it was around the time, probably the first year that I was living in L.A., and he would just, Freddie would program in these combinations. You could see him, like, just da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, he would just do it, and he would move. And the combination he knocked him out with was what they were working on. But you're right. It's like Pacquiao has to be willing to kind of be in there and stay in there. And now it seems like he goes 1, 2, 3, and he gets out, as opposed to before there might have been 5 shots in there, then he gets out. But Bradley squares up. He likes to trade too long, and when he starts to trade, that's when he squares up. And I think he could leave Pacquiao, if he stays in the pocket, room to put him on his ass and maybe put him out because he does have that chin. Let me ask you guys this. First fight, is this fight going to be better than the first fight?
I don't really think so. I think that anybody who wins this, well, Bradley, I think he's talking a little too much, and I'm getting the sense he feels like he has something to prove. Because I think Bradley's the type of person that gets emotional with what fans say about him. Pacquiao doesn't really care. He's always kind of happy-go-lucky, and you really can't tell if he's getting annoyed by something. He might say it. I think the one time I saw him get annoyed was when Floyd's father said he was on roids or something like that. But, I don't know. I kind of just get the feeling like – and I kind of get the feeling like it won't matter if Bradley loses this fight. Because it's just better for him money-wise and career-wise to get a triple fight with Pacquiao. But
I think he is getting annoyed. I think Manny is getting annoyed with Timothy. You know, I mean, I think Manny's looking at him like, dude, you're talking like you did a shutout on me. You know, it was controversial. You can still argue that Manny won that fight or Timothy won that fight. You know, I think everybody's going to have a different perspective of what they're witnessing. And I think the way I found out that Manny Pacquiao got annoyed by Timothy Bradley finally is by reciting a scripture, basically telling him, like, dude, you're not even humble about it. Okay, you won. That's why we're doing a rematch. To answer your question, do you think this fight's going to be better than the second one? Was the first one even really that good? There was drama in it, but it wasn't really like a fight that I would go back and watch again. The only reason I'm going back and watching it again is like to see what adjustments did both fighters got to do. But other than that, I could care less about the first fight. I'm hoping that it's at least at least a little bit more entertaining, especially since the hardworking fight fans out there got to dish out their hard work or earn money to watch this.
Yeah,
anyway,
I don't know. The mental stuff. The last few years, the people like the 24/7. I used to like the maybe 5-10 minute little segment before a fight that would lead you in and it's all good. That was enough for me. All these 24/7s, and then it becomes a story. To me, it's just garbage.
Yeah,
you know, like
they're on 24/7.
What's that?
Pacquiao Bradley's on 24/7.
Yeah, I think so, right?
I believe it. We have an episode. Yeah, I saw it somewhere. I haven't watched it. I just don't go in for the. It, all the storyline stuff, for me, it just comes down to styles anymore. Maybe that's just, I don't know.
Oh,
old and bitter.
God,
but,
that's what I wanted to. That's what I wanted to call in for. The 24/7. As a matter of fact, you just brought it up for me. I just really like. There was a time ago where I was watching some MMA fights, and I was thinking about boxing while I was watching the MMA, and I was like, man, you know, there's something about MMA that it's starting to get like boxing, and a lot of MMA fans are complaining about it because back a few years ago it was like boxing versus MMA. MMA is so much better. You know, business-wise, we get the fights we want. Now it's not like that anymore because it picked up steam. And the thing is that when you're as big as boxing is and you're getting big like MMA, media tries to get to the fighters more. When media gets to the fighters start building opinions. When fighters start building opinions, they start building power. And then the promoter is not kind of like, you know, the guy who makes the fights is kind of like, you know, all right, well, who do you want to fight? Since you're the personality now, you know, who do you want to fight? I got to appease you and your fans because your fans are going to listen to you. And that's kind of how it happens. And in boxing, the promoters see that, and the promoters start building up fighters like Adrian Broner who really are easy to handle because they lack intelligence. Oh, yes, I just went there, Adrian Broner. Hold that if you're listening. they lack intelligence. They can't really drive themselves. That's why you got to give Floyd credit at some degree because he did do it himself and he kind of used the promoters instead of letting the promoters use him. But promoters will use fighters now, aim them towards the pop culture of today because it's easier to promote. And they kind of just let the pop culture and the media give this guy an opinion, a personality, because they know he's going to say stupid crap and they know he's going to do like these Twitter votes of fighters. Nobody asked Adrian Broner to fight Maidana. Okay, that's a fact. The fact that he lost was even more embarrassing. And it just happens like that. And I think that's where the problem of boxing is. Back in the day, fighters used to get asked questions at press conferences, and that was it. Like, it was like, how you're doing, how's training, boom, that's it, done. Go train up for the fight. And now it's not like that.
Here's the thing, though, about giving credit to Floyd Mayweather. I'm going to give him credit to a certain degree. But to say that he was smart enough to do things his way because he had the general idea of how to maneuver himself to the top, I can't agree with that. It's almost like saying Oscar De La Hoya put Golden Boy on the map, and he was the sole drive of building that brand. These guys make enough money and when they hit a certain point of their career that they can hire the right people to give them the right direction, to help them make the right decisions.
That's
what Floyd has done, you know? So he was smart enough to understand that, just like Oscar was, by saying, you know what, I don't have the business fundamentals of building a brand. I need to hire the guys that can do that. And they both did, which is brilliant, you know. But I agree with you in an extent of what you're talking about. I agree with you. Rob, I'm going to let you go, brother. I'll put you back on hold. Thanks for calling in, man. Always appreciate it.
Great stuff,
right, man.
Thanks.
Great show. All right.
Fight fans, you want to call in, you certainly can. 347-215-7598. Let's patch in some other fight fans here. I got two area codes, 111. I'll let one through. Let me see. Area code 111. Go ahead. You're on live right now. Leaving the ring. What's on your mind? No? Okay. Area code, the other one. Area code 111. You're on live right now. Leaving the ring. What's on your mind? Hello? You there?
Keep breathing.
Okay. All right. Well, fight fans, you want to call in 347-215-7598. You certainly can. Let's talk boxing here on Leaving the Ring. Let's talk. You know what? Let's talk about a match that some people are kind of downing on. You know, if you think when Danny Garcia had announced, Golden Boy had announced that he was going to be fighting Mauricio Herrera. A lot of people were bagging on that. They were saying it was a terrible fight. It was not going to be a good fight. You know, really undermined what Herrera was bringing to the table. You got a similar fight like this. Now, similar in terms of toughness, Carlos Molina brings a toughness to the table against Adrian Broner. Now, is it pay-per-view worthy? Absolutely not. But how many of these fights that end up on pay-per-view are pay-per-view worthy? Not a lot of them. Sorry. There's only a few that you can probably come off the top of your head for the past 5 years where you could say that that was actually worth wanting to wait for and watch. But this is what I like about this Carlos Molina fight. Now, I know many expected Adrian Broner to jump at the next big thing out there to prove that the Marcos Madonna fight was a fluke. And that's what most want to have expected and wanted to see from Adrian Broner. But I like the move that his team decided to do, which was not take on the Amir Khan fight, shy away from that, and move on to something less, which is kind of redeem himself and find back that confidence. So they picked Carlos Molina, which is a tough, cagey little guy. Now, does Molina bring the IQ that Herrera does? Probably not, but he's durable, okay? He's durable, and he's got something there that a lot of folks are not pointing out. And the one thing that they're not pointing out is that Adrian Broner is not as mobile or as quick to move away from a punch or a counterpunch at 147. Look at his body size. His body size really has changed since leaving the 130-135. You know, 130-135, when he fought like an Eloy Perez and even an Antonio DeMarco, he had some footwork behind him. He was able to really move himself away. Look at him now. He's got a really heavy top. His legs are really skinny. They're not allowing him to kind of give himself some movement, some movement to get away from the punches that are being thrown at him. He's really stationary. He's really there to be hit. And that's what I like about the fight, is that Adrian Broner's kind of proven he's not really a true 147-pounder guy. He's a guy that couldn't really make the weight anymore. Did he skip 140 to avoid the potential fights that were there for him? Or was it because he couldn't make the weight at 140? So that's why the big decision was to move to 147. Now, Molina and his team, what they should really look at is what is the obvious there with Adrian Broner? And the obvious is exactly what I just mentioned right now. Very stationary, doesn't move a lot anymore. He's there to be hit. And guess what? He tries to use his hand speed to get himself out of situation. Doesn't have power there. He hasn't had like a definite power at 147. If he connects and he continues to connect, he absolutely can get you out of there with punishment. But Carlos Molina was outboxed by Amir Khan, who is, to me, a bigger guy than Adrian Broner, but at the same time is able to carry that weight with his footwork. Very bad footwork, but he's still able to get out of the pocket when needed. His hand speed is troublesome when Amir Khan applies it. And there's another thing, is that Amir Khan, who's got power at 140, not sure about 147 yet, but at 140, wasn't able to take out Carlos Molina. So it makes me to wonder, could Adrian Broner take out Carlos Molina in their match? And if not, what does Adrian Broner revert to? Because he's become more of a take your time, look for the money punch, one shot, throw it, and then look again. Reset yourself again. And that, to me, is where Molina, in my opinion, could take advantage of it. Gabriel?
You know, I mean, we were talking the other day about this, and I was so ready to disagree with you, you know. The thing is, I mean, you know, Molina doesn't have a lot of power. So I think, but he does hit strong. It's kind of like Paulie like that. He has nice technique. He will commit. He will engage. Will his feet be able to handle it? Will his body? I see this fight ending on a body shot for some reason, but would Broner catch him to the body and putting him down? It's just my kind of first impressions of the match. But the fight is there so that Broner looks good and wins. Molina brings an added flavor in that he bleeds at times, so there's a possibility of blood, which fans always love, and judges love it even more. So whatever you know, Molina might be getting done with his fists, if he's bleeding all over the place, that could be something for the judges, a way for them to overlook his success with his fists. But you're right. I mean, I think if he decides, all right, these are the things I can do, these are the things I can't, and he really accepts reality for what it is, and I'm just going to touch this guy and move and box him, never let him get set, never let him kind of be in space, and I'm just staring at him, and he punches me in the face. But just keep moving and boxing and doing what I do best, I'll win. If Carlos decides to do that, he's all good. If he decides not to and he kind of goes the other way and really just goes in there and, you know, does a valiant loss, then we'd get exactly what I thought we'd get. And, you know, Broner might land that body shot and get an added bonus. But I don't know. The whole card to me, I'm just not that particularly excited by the thing. I don't know how you feel about it, but it just doesn't really excite me at all. You know, it doesn't. It's not why I watch boxing. I understand developmental. I understand get back, but, like, I don't know. People have to have a chance, don't they?
You know, here's the thing is that I'm not really excited about the card, even though Amir Khan Colazo is a good fight, but I don't think it should be on pay-per-view. It's a fight that should end up on Boxing After Dark, all those fights. We all love the underdog. Marcos Maidana, I think we all would like to see him prevail. Like I was telling you the other day, talking to my older brother is a casual fan. And he honestly believes that Marcos Maidana has a major chance of knocking out Floyd Mayweather, which I'm like, dude, show me where. I mean, how? I mean, where are you seeing this at? Because I need to take off my glasses and clean them because I'm not seeing it. But that's why these pay-per-views are made, because you have casual fans that really don't know the sport. And they're not complaining about dishing out their hard-earned money because they feel, well, if it's getting on pay-per-view, these guys obviously know what they're doing. Yeah, they obviously know what they're doing. They're con men. They're conning you into pulling out your wallet. You know? I mean, if you're going to be robbed and you're going to smile about it, let me know who you are so I can just go knock on your door and not even bring a gun or anything or a ski mask and just knock on the door and say, hey, I'm here to take your money. Right? That's a big problem with boxing. A lot of us don't throw it out there that this is kind of BS. You know, a lot of us forget that we put in 40 overtime hours, 40 hours in a week in overtime just to privilege ourselves with this pay-per-view. When this really belongs, just on a regular network. You know, good thing Stephen Cunningham and Amir Mansour, which is, you know, not on pay-per-view, on an undercard. It's actually going to be on CBS Sports. And even tonight, the heavyweight fights on Golden Boy. You know, that's going to be on Fox Sports 1. But I'm not too happy about it. I mean, even with the – if you know, somebody asked me, like, you know, what fight do you feel happy about paying or that you feel comfortable with paying? You know, I was on the Bunches and Punches for Tony Whitby. Great show. Love the guy, man. They bring up a lot of great topics. You know, they always ask me to come on, man. Great show. Got to tune and listen to it. And he's like, what fight do you feel that you'll be comfortable with of dishing out your hard-earned money? And I said, you know, Cotto Martinez. But really, honestly, we're paying to see two older warriors go at it, you know? Well, it should have happened a while back, maybe. You know, I mean, Cotto obviously still needed – he had issues. You know, but he really hasn't proved to me he's a middleweight. And Martinez hasn't proved to me that his body is going to be receptive of being in the ring for 12 hard-earned rounds. You know, so – I'm really paying for to see the what-ifs in that fight. I'm not paying to see a great fight. I'm paying to see two old warriors to see what they got left and if they make a great fight. That's what I'm paying for.
I'm kind of curious about this fight tonight, actually. I'm jumping forward because we got about 10 minutes, 11 minutes to go. We'll get into the fight schedule. Dominic Brazil versus Nagy Aguilera. Now, did you watch Dominic Brazil's last fight?
I did.
Against Brutus from Popeye. Omedo Fonseca was his name. He struggled. And I know you're going to say you're crazy. Like, I'm not calling for the upset special, because I don't know what kind of shape Nagy Aguilera is in. But he's a young dude. He's 27. He's got, you know, okay, 7 losses. 2 of them are knockouts. But the guys that knocked him out were Chris Areola back in 2011, May.
Yep.
And before that, was Samuel Peter, 2010, March.
Yes.
Other guys that he's lost to, Antonio Tarver, Mo Harris, those are both in, you know, back-to-back in 2010, two-month span. But they both went the distance. He went the distance with Mo Harris for the vacant USBA title, and then he went the distance with Tarver's 10 rounds. He gets knocked out by Ariel in his next fight. But then he picks up a win, goes distance with Tomasz Hadowick in 2012, March, which, you know, we think that guy is a quality dude at that point, you know, Hadowick. I mean, people, he's kind of fading. You know, he's coming towards, you know, he's rounding the bend towards the end. But Hadowick still got some things. He can go distance over the fight with Glaskov. Showed that maybe that was the last of it, but he still had some fire in him. So I think Aguilar is a quality guy. This is an interesting fight for Dominic Brazil, who struggled against, you know, Romero Fonseca, who was grossly overweight. He's not the kind of guy that you want to even see in the ring. I think that's an interesting fight. And maybe Golden Boy is kind of moving towards those right developmental fights. I don't know, or they're maybe going to get their guy beat. Luis Ortiz versus Monty Barrett, heavyweights as well, 10 rounds. Gerald Washington versus Skip Scott. Also, this is Night of Heavyweights, Fantasy Springs. Also, that's actually tomorrow night. Tomorrow night, Friday, the Odyssey Arena in Belfast, Northern Ireland, on Box Nation. Carl the Jackal Frampton versus Hugo Cazares, super bantamweight, 12 rounds, WBC eliminator. Very fun fight. Can't wait to see it. I'm a big fan of Frampton's. I think the guy's just really fun to watch. But Hugo Cazares is going to give him a hell of a fight. I think that's a hell of a clash there. Stephen Ormond versus Kareem El Awuzgari, why did I get into that name? Lightweights, 10 rounds, when I didn't have to. At the Leah Koras Center in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, on NBC Sports, Amir Mansour versus Steve USS Cunningham, heavyweights, 10 rounds. In the undercard there, co-feature, Curtis Stevens versus Turiano Johnson, middleweights, 10 rounds. That's going to be a fun fight. Remember, we had Turiano Johnson on here. He's a very eloquent man, downright loquacious. Undefeated, springing Curtis Stevens. Probably a nice stiff test. This is a nice crossroads bout. Stevens wants to be relevant. Turiano Johnson wants to be relevant himself and move to the next contender level. Go to the next level, young man. And if he wins, he'll be able to do that. I haven't really made a pick in this. I'm leaning towards Stevens. I think his power might be the real deal. But, you know, Turiano Johnson, I'd heard good things about him. And speaking with him, he seemed like an intelligent guy with all the right tools and the right attitude. So very curious to see how this fight goes. But who do you like in Amir Mansour versus Steve Cunningham? It's a very trippy fight.
It's a trippy fight as well. It's really styles make fights. You got Amir Mansour, who's – I was telling you this earlier. He reminds me of a really poor version of Ray Mercer, not in boxing skills but in size. You know, where they're solid, solid and strong. But Amir doesn't have that level of boxing skill that can really take him to the top. He's got really, I mean, you know, what's that one football heavyweight that was Seth Mitchell. Seth Mitchell is a better fighter than Amir, in my opinion. You know, Amir,
yes.
Yeah, way more. Got a good jab. He could set up punches, got good combinations, aggressive. But we don't know where Amir stands at in terms of getting hit solid and if he can get himself out of just instinct. Cunningham can definitely outbox him, but Cunningham's not a true heavyweight, you know, and he can have some definite problems if Amir is able to land a big, solid punch. The thing, too, is that Cunningham's not going to be able to lay on him, put his body weight against Amir to kind of push him back to the ropes or even try to smother him up, because I could just picture Amir pushing him off and then kind of falling in with one of his winging punches and hurting Steve Cunningham. So this fight is really the crossroad for Cunningham. Can he maintain discipline? Can he stay boxing? Because to me, he's going to have to use the whole ring in order to outbox Amir Mansour and not really try to engage with them punch for punch, power for power. That'd be the dumbest thing for him to do. He's got to go in there understanding he's a smaller guy. He's the more sound guy, and that he's a smaller guy. Mansour's got to go in there knowing that he can be easily outboxed by the smaller guy that's going to use footwork and he's going to be darting in and out. So he's got to close that distance quick. He's got to kind of let Stevenson know that I'm the big guy and I'm going to take control and make this into an ugly physical fight. That being said, I'm going to pick Amir Mansour, man. I think that he's going to be able to get Cunningham out of there. I think Cunningham is going to fall asleep in a split second in one of these rounds that he's being dominant, and boom, he's out of there. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I kind of have the same feeling about the fight, is that Cunningham will have control in spots, but the physical strength, the kind of bum rushing that will happen, you know, over and over again. Steve has all the tools to just keep turning all night, boxing smart behind the jab, and box his way to victory. He really does. But that chin, it's not like it's bad, but it can be gotten to. And I could see it late, you know, happening where Mansour is just in it, still there, just kind of fighting through. Oh, and I think no matter how it goes, we're going to find out what Mansour has. I think we know the depth of Cunningham. I mean, he's a real, honest, good, hardworking fighter. He's going to give you an honest effort, and he's going to give you everything that he's got. He's not afraid of that. But Mansour, we just don't know. He's 41 years old. He's also the smaller guy. Like, he's more, he's got the natural, I think, probably more strength and more the natural heavyweight here. But, you know, Steve is a former two-time cruiserweight champion. He's a quality fighter. He's also 6'3 with an 82-inch reach to Mansour's 6'1, 74-inch reach. It's an interesting thing, and I did an interview this week with Steve, and he talked about how they had sparred back in 2010. So they're kind of familiar with each other in a sense. Mansour, he probably is a different fighter on some levels than he was back in 2010 when they sparred a couple times. But overall, he's still kind of that raw package. So I imagine Steve had to learn a few times during that how to deal with somebody that's so raw and like kind of wild and unpredictable in that sense, in terms of trajectory of his punches and everything. So I don't know. I think he'll be able to handle him. I think Steve gets put down late and maybe even stopped late. I just have a funky feeling about it. I'm gonna roll with your pick as well.
You know, Cunningham's game plan to me is to jab. In training camp, that's the one thing that you should have put a lot of focus on and put weights on is the jab. Put some weights on that jab, work that jab, until that jab is just raw and it feels like a big chunk of meat. Because that's what you do to a smaller stature fighter, a stocky guy, is you jab him, you keep making him weave until he tires himself out because he's trying to avoid that jab. If he doesn't have the jab coming into this fight and he decides to engage with him with short punches and in the pocket, you're setting yourself up for failure, because that's where Mansour wants to be, is right there in that pocket where he can land one of these big, wild shots. Cunningham has to be smart enough. Now, the problem with Cunningham, like you just mentioned a little while ago, he's fought some really good quality fighters, and he can fight when he needs to fight. But that, to me, is his downfall sometimes, especially moving up in weight and going against these bigger guys that are going to outweigh him maybe 20, 30 pounds, is that you can't get brave sometimes, you know? The bullfighter doesn't try to grab the horns of the bull and tackle him to the ground. He tries to outmaneuver him and catch him on the side to beat the bull. That's what Cunningham's got to do. He's got to keep turning him with the jab, turn him with the jab, tire him out, bring him into those 5-6 rounds, 7 rounds, and then you start opening up with some combinations. But then you stay humble and true to what got you to those later rounds, which would be your jab. If he can establish that and he can do and stick to that game plan with discipline, then this should be a really good, fairly somewhat easy win for him. But something's telling me that his ego is always going to kick in, it's going to sting, and he's going to go in there, get touched, and say, I got something to prove. Give me a screenshot. I got something to prove. Go ahead.
Moving on to the next day, we've got at Stadthal in Rostock, Germany, on ARD and /BoxNation, Jürgen Brammer versus Enzo Macarnelli, light heavyweights, 12 rounds for Brammer's WBA title. I'm going with Brammer in this one. Macarnelli's been stopped 6 times. It accounts for all of his losses. He hasn't lost in 3 fights, that is correct, but I just... I don't know. It's hard for me to bet on him. I know he's got decent power. I know he's got resiliency, but I know he also gets knocked out. Robert's no spring chicken at 35 years old, but he's got, you know, capable hands. He's got the capable skills, and he hasn't lost since, I think, 2008, something like that. I know he's got a couple losses, but, yeah, since 2008. So, I don't know. Styles make fights. I like Bronner in this. I think that Macronelli wouldn't be here if they didn't feel that they could beat him. So, there you go. I'm taking that fight. And finally, your call, London, England, Sky Sports, John Ryder versus Jess Wilson, middleweights, 12 rounds, prize fighter, welterweight tournament. And that is your weekend fight schedule.
Well, there you go, fight fans. Again, we'll be back Thursday, same time, same channel. Don't forget to download the app and rate it. You can get it on your iPhone and on your Android. If you missed the show, you can catch it on the archives on the app. You can catch the archives of the next round. You can catch the archives of Boxeo Tijuana Radio, and you can catch the archives of Leaving the Ring Radio. Tune in. Keep supporting. I want to thank everybody out there that continues to support Leaving the Ring, continue to make the show strong along with the other shows, and continue to show the respect that we ask for, and I think we've earned it because we respect everybody else out there that's putting in the work and doing this as a hobby, you know, and not worried about what numbers they bring in, what they do and this and that, and think that they need to go in and insult other people because they think that's the way to go about of being number one, okay? Anyways, don't forget, don't drink and drive this weekend because you will spill your beer. I'm your host, Dave Duenas, with my co-host, Mr. Gable Montoya, and you guys have a good weekend because I know I am.
Peace.